Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, if owing to failures of personal integrity, a good system is misused, it can easily become a source of harm rather than a source of benefit. This is a general truth which applies to all fields of human activity, even religion. Though religion certainly has the potential to help people lead meaningful and happy lives, it too, when misused, can become a source of conflict and division. Similarly, in the fields of commerce and finance, the systems themselves may be sound, but if the people using them are unscrupulous and driven by self-serving greed, the benefits of those systems will be undermined. Unfortunately, we see this happening in many kinds of human activities, even in international sports, where corruption threatens the very notion of fair play. Of course, many discerning people are aware of these problems and are working sincerely to redress them from within their own areas of expertise. Politicians, civil servants, lawyers, educators, environmentalists, activists, and so on, people from all sides are already engaged in this effort. This is very good so far as it goes, but the fact is, we will never solve our problems simply by instituting new laws and regulations. Ultimately, the source of our problems lies at the level of the individual. If people lack moral values and integrity, no system of laws and regulations will be adequate. So long as people give priority to material values, then injustice, corruption, inequity, intolerance, and greed, all the outward manifestations of neglect of inner values, will persist.
Well, we have circled around back to Beyond Religion. And that's the book titled
The Dalai Lama. That was the Dalai Lama, was it?
Yes, it was. Yes. And you spoke to that issue. I mean, you really, really focused on ethical, moral principles and people taking responsibility. Let's first, before I ask the question, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I find it interesting that the Dalai Lama has included in the people who are working to correct the problem. He's got in there such people as politicians and activists and a whole list of people, environmentalists and so on. My experience is that although there are people of integrity in those groups, they are very few and far between. And for the most part, those particular groups are the problem, not the solution, because they are each trapped and blinkered by their own vision of how things should be, and only their way is right. And so this creates more and more division. We shouldn't have all these segments of people doing this, that group doing that. We should be seeing ourselves as humanity, the human beings that own and live on planet Earth in the solar scheme of things, in the universal scheme of things. The sentient beings on this planet are we human beings. And it's all these divisions of who is right about a particular thing that cause so many of our problems. Look at all the environmentalists who are screaming, you know, global warming. And equally on the other side, a number of scientists are saying, this is nonsense. This is just another thing to raise money or fund the green program or whatever. So I would take issue very much with that long list of people. And I guess one of the things that resonates with me is that saying, and it's something like this: if you don't recognize the past in the present, you and change it in the present, you will be doomed to repeat it in the future. And that is what I think is so important and what we need to look at. Yes, we need standards setting out. Yes, we need social and moral laws that are acceptable to everybody. Yes, above all, we need integrity and common sense as individuals and taking responsibility for ourselves. But nonetheless, even the best-hearted, most willing person's ability and is filled with common sense and integrity is not actually going to get very far unless they really understand the history of we humans on this planet, how we got to where we are, and what the result is that we're seeing now, where it has in fact come from, how we have arrived at this point. Because until we learn from the history, we won't be able to correct it into the future. And it will just keep going on and on and on. I think you made a comment last time we spoke about the present situation. And excuse me if I sound a bit odd today. My ears are really weird. We've got a lot of smoke in the valley and the air quality is terrible. But back to what I was saying, you had mentioned the other day that things had blown up badly in Atlantis. And were we doing the same thing with our planet again? Well, actually, the situation, in a way, is much more serious now than it was then, primarily because there were a lot fewer people, and therefore a lot less people could get killed, damaged, and harmed by what was going on the planet. Today, billions of people can get harmed by what's going on. So we really have to look at where we came from, what we want to be. We have to decide ourselves what we want to be as the human species. Imagine if some alien is coming from, let's say, Andromeda, and they turn up in your house. How do you want them to perceive you? How do you want total stranger to see the human being on this planet? Because right now, we are pretty much seen as confused, chaotic, warlike, not knowing what we were doing, and ready for stealing and taking. And that's why they can snatch us. Nobody, it isn't that we want everybody to be afraid of us. We want to welcome strangers into our homes. But we do need to earn their respect. And we're not able, even with the best of intentions, to earn that respect unless we clarify to ourselves as individuals, this is who I am. This is my history, and this is where I want to go in the future. I think until we each do that, all these lists of people who are maybe doing bits of good here, there, and everywhere are really not going to make any serious inroads. We need a much deeper individual change than that. So that's what I think about what the Dalai Lama's list was.
Well, he's got a... I thought, yeah, it's a great book, and he approaches and and deals with some great issues. Well, we do have some division here. Let's talk about a recent decision by the Supreme Court. Give me your read on Roe versus Wade. They ended that, you know, after 50 years. What do you say? The Supreme Court says no one can have abortions now. For whatever reason you say you need to have an abortion, they said that's out. Is that what I understand, or am I on target here?
Well, I think that's really, I think what they have said is that they have overthrown Roe versus Wade, so there is no longer that protection in law, and then they have turned it back to the states, and many of the states, like Texas, that are extreme right-wing states, are saying no abortions under any circumstances. Other states, I believe Georgia was one, said you can only have an abortion in the first 6 weeks of pregnancy, which is, of course, is ridiculous because most women are probably not even aware they're pregnant then. So the whole thing is a mess, and it's a tragedy because from time immemorial, women have taken steps to avoid unwanted pregnancies. And we have to remember that many of the unwanted pregnancies come about not just because people are using abortion instead of contraception, which some politicians said, and which I thought was absolutely ridiculous. Clearly he was a man and he'd never even had the experience of a pelvic exam, let alone an abortion. Statement is utterly ridiculous, I think. But people do have views about the morality of abortion. And if I may, I'm not going to make a judgment on this, because I am of the belief that every woman needs to make that decision in the best interest of her health and her family's health and the future potential child's health. So I don't believe that it is a matter for government or men in general. I believe it's a matter for the women involved. Having said that, I will tell you what Spirit says about this, and they are quite clear that, first of all, they object to all the indiscriminate sex, which often can lead to unwanted pregnancies. And they do wish humans would be a little bit more circumspect in the matter of how they interact sexually with one another, you know, a little bit more discerning. They're not against it, but just a little bit more discerning. As to the abortion issue, according to Spirit, the potential child is nothing more than a biological entity of a group of cells meeting and dividing, 12 to even 16 weeks of pregnancy, because it is somewhere between the 12th and the 16th week of pregnancy that a soul chooses that child as a future body. It is that entity, that fetus, is not offered a soul until the end of the first trimester, in between the 12th and the 16th month, when we move into this quick, what they call the quickening, where they feel the baby move for the first time. That is the signal that a soul has laid claim to that body. So from then on, you are dealing with a potential future person. It's still not a person, but it is a potential future person. Prior to that time, in the first trimester, to be honest, and this might upset a few people, but really and truly, although I would not personally wish to have an abortion at any price, it is really, in that first few weeks, no different than trimming your fingernails from a spiritual point of view. It simply is not recognized as a child. Now, this is not acceptable for many people because of their religious beliefs. They believe that the moment of conception is the beginning of that person. It is the beginning of life, but it is not the beginning of ensouled life. It is simply a potential person, and until a soul lays claim to it, it is not a person. So that is Spirit's view on the matter. So for all those women out there, and I want to say unfortunate women, who have had to undergo, for whatever reason, the misery and discomfort and emotional toll of an abortion, I say to them, don't castigate yourself spiritually, because there is no spiritual mistake in that choice, that it's acceptable, and besides, Spirit understands everything. And always remember that the Almighty up there knows why you do everything. So there's no blame attached to this. There's no sense of blame. It would be far better, I think, if the government did legislate, if the Congress legislated on something like Roe versus Wade, that laid down some rules with regard to abortion, you know, saying that it should be, say, between a woman and her doctor, and if the doctor agrees, then it goes ahead. But it's going to be a long problem for a long time, and sadly, it will be the people of color, the people of Asian birth, and the poor people. They're the ones that will suffer. Rich people can always get an abortion. They can jump on a plane and fly to Sweden, the same as they've always done. And it's the poor, as always, when the Congress or the Supreme Court makes these kinds of rulings, it is always the poor who suffer for it. never the rich. It won't make any difference to the rich.
Okay, but you're telling me that, and a lot of people from the Catholic Church and other churches, or Baptists, whatever, they really believe that at the time of conception, that's when the child shouldn't be tampered with. And you're saying...
Yeah, I know that. I go on.
Great, but you're saying that's wrong. You're saying that if...
Yes, I'm saying that's wrong. Well, I'm categorically saying they are mistaken. I understand that they believe that. The Chinese believe that. The Chinese mark your birthday from the moment of conception in many of the Chinese and Oriental cultures. And that's their choice. That's their view of things. And like everything else, we all have a choice. What I'm saying is that as far as spiritual reality is concerned, that is a mistaken point of view. Not a bad point of view, but it is a mistaken point of view.
Wow. So all this fighting and knock down, drag out is almost to naught. I mean, not quite that. I'm not trying to dismiss this, but from what I understand, you're saying as an Anunnaki, as a person who has been on this planet several times in the last 100,000 years, that an EBE is not a person. It is not until a soul, wherever it comes from. Where does the soul come? Soul decides that it will enter that body. It won't do it before the 12th week. Is that what you say?
Right. Yes. Yes.
Wow.
That's exactly
a different concept.
What I'm saying. You know what? And there's a logic to this. Spirit. One thing spirit does not ever do, and I use the term spirit generically, you know, it includes all angelic beings, holy beings, saints, what you name it. I just use the generic term of spirit to keep it. The one thing spirit never ever does is waste the energy of the universe, because it is possible and highly probable that there is a finite amount of energy in the universe, and that if we've all gobbled it up, our universe could go away and we would go away with it. So in order to try and avoid that disaster for as long as possible, spirit is extremely careful about the use of energy. And apply that to what I just said about souls. The soul that is going to take that future body will not waste the energy required to go in and out of that body until it is satisfied that there is a viable potential child there that is likely to be born. Historically, most natural miscarriages, spontaneous abortions, occur within the first 12 weeks of pregnancy. 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 12 weeks. You ask any gynecologist and they will tell you, oh, if you get past the 12th week, you're probably good. You know, even women who have problems, they say, well, if you make it past 12 weeks, you're probably good. The whole medical profession knows that it's the first 12 weeks of pregnancy that are the most dangerous for spontaneous abortion, miscarriage. So spirit is not going to waste soul energy going in and out of what can be come to nothing. It can come to nothing. But once that first trimester is passed, then you have potentially a baby that will develop to full term and be born in the normal way. And so that's the point where the soul enters that child, and it doesn't take up full-time residence, but it goes in and out. And the mother always knows the moment when it takes up residence, because that's the first time the child in the womb moves, right? And you remember in the Bible, Mary goes to visit her cousin Elizabeth. And when Elizabeth sees Mary and sees that she's pregnant, she says, the child in my womb has quickened. Yeah, that's when the soul takes over.
Okay.
Any woman knows she has that time when the first time that the baby moves within her, And that's the moment when the soul has taken up residence in that infant. Prior to that time, it is just a biological entity.
Wow, wow. Where does the soul come from, if I may? If you're saying that...
Well, let us hope that it's coming from a heavenly place, right? That it's a heavenly soul, a good soul coming in, and not something unpleasant or from the dark side that's sneaking in. I mean, it's come from wherever it's been since it last was in a body. You know, throughout all eternity, our souls are either in bodies or out of bodies, one or the other. So we're either living out some make-believe existence on the astral plane while we wait for another body, or we're coming back into a body to reincarnate and experience another life.
Uh-huh.
They're not making a lot of new souls today. Like the ground that we walk on. They're not making any more of it, right? So I don't know that any new souls are arriving. They're already experienced.
So if that's true here on Earth with the human being, how about with the Anunnaki on the spaceship? How about with the Greys? How about with the Palladians? How about the reptilians or the insectoids or there are many, many different other entities besides the human being on this planet now.
Right.
Now, are you saying that only the human being has a soul?
No, of course not.
Well, how about the reptilian?
Most beings throughout the universe have soul energy. You've asked me before, and other people have asked me about Tillians, and I will say again, I don't know that much about them, but this is what I do know. They do not belong in our universe. When our universe first came into being, I was given to understand that the creative explosion from the source, from the all, that manifested our universe simultaneously manifested 294 other universes. Now, this is Anunnaki cosmology. This is what they have counted, right? They know that there are 294 other universes, and that right at the core of these universes is the source, where it all comes out from, the source of all the light that manifests everything in the creation. And all the intelligence that manifests everything in the creation. Now, we tend to call that source God, right? That's okay. I don't care what anybody calls it. There is a central source. Nobody knows who or what that source is in reality or where it came from. I am only telling you what the Anunnaki cosmology is as far as they understand it at this point. And they do not claim to fully understand it by any manner of means. But they do know that there are these other universes. And they also know that eons ago, there was something happened in this central core which should never have happened. It was like a glitch in heaven. They jokingly say it was a glitch in heaven. But what happened was that it allowed the reptilian beings from another universe, a group of them, to get through into our universe. Now, that normally cannot happen. Every universe is, I'm not talking about the parallel dimensions of our universe. I'm talking about a completely different universe, right? They came from a completely different universe, and they were a small group, you might say a group of explorers, and they made a base for themselves in a star system, on a star called Draco. The system of Draco. That's why we call them draconian, right? And from there, they evolved through eons of time. They've been there long before humans were on the scene, long before Earth existed. The reptilians were on Draco at the early stages of the universe. And from there, they have developed themselves and evolved into a major space-faring species. They're all over the universe, highly intelligent. And the one thing I do know about them from a personal thing is that their family grouping is a grouping of five. They're always in groups of five. Like we might say, we are in couples. Humans go in couples, men and women. The reptilians go, I understand, in groups of five. And they have a completely different value system to the kind of things that humans have. And remember that the others, like you mentioned, the Pleiadians, the Great East people, they are all good, bad, or indifferent, part of the human species in this universe. The reptilians are from outside this universe and are quite different. And it is that total mental and physical difference that makes them so dangerous, because they have no moral compunction about the things that they do. For example, if they ran into a time of starvation, any group of five would take a vote among themselves, and one of them would offer up themselves to be roasted and eaten by the others in a time of starvation. This is good behavior to them, but it would be horrible cannibalism to us. So you have to understand the reptilians are quite different, and we cannot include them and their standards, mores, and values and judge them in the same way that we do humans. Now, the humans are a species throughout our universe. They're all some form of human. They may look different, they may seem to be different, but they are. This universe is the human species, and we are the experience of Earth human species, or Homo sapien on planet Earth. The Anunnaki, again, are quite different because they are the beings of the beginning. You remember the Bible tells you the story how the Creator created everything, and then the first species he created was the angelic species that sit in heaven, excuse me, the ones that stay up in the high heaven, you know, the seraphim, the cherubim, and all the great angels of the cosmos. And they never come to Earth, and their only job, praise the source. That's all they have to do all the time. They're not interested in the creation. They're just interested in praising and supporting through their praise the source itself, right? The light, right? Next, after them, were created the angelic species that were able to come into the creation. And they were asked by the creative source, and this is a way of understanding it, right? Because how it exactly happened, I don't know. I wasn't there, right? But it's as if they were asked to come down into the creation and report back to the creator what was happening at the lower levels. Step down, step down, step down. Now, according to the Anunnaki cosmology, Earth manifests at the 22nd level of compression of light. In other words, we are at 22 steps down from the Almighty. It's not surprising that we can't understand the Almighty, because he's 22 levels of experience above us. In our soul's development and learning, we will gradually evolve up through all those 22 steps. So you can tell we've got a long way to go. But when those angelic beings came down, they were beings of light, and they came directly from the source. They did not evolve out of the creation. They were part of the creation. They were created by the Creator as perfect beings of light. Right? They come down into the creation. They start reporting back. And you may well ask, why would the Creator needs somebody to report back to him? Let's call him a him. Why would the Creator need somebody to report back to him? Well, I'll tell you why. Because once the Creator created, once the Big Bang and all the intelligent light was burst out and made into all these levels of the creation, they were locked into time. As soon as you have a level of manifestation, you have to have a polarization. You have, because otherwise, with no polarization, there is no manifestation. You can't see something if there's nothing there. And to have something there, you have to have hot, cold, left, right, up, down, made manifest within a sequence, an order. It has to be put into order to be manifest. Now, order is the law of the universe, order, right? Now, when you get things in order, how do you keep them in order? Well, you keep them in order by setting them into time with a beginning, a middle, and an end, a process going from point A to point B to point C continually. So you lock the manifestation into a time. And so the source needed his angelic species to go down into that time and report back, because the source itself exists outside time. There's a whole different understanding, because there is no time. Therefore, it is not possible even for the source to be, let's say, observant and understanding of what's happening in the creation unless it is reported back to him, or it, or whatever, however you want to think of the Creator.
How about her?
Because there is no, that, well, her then, I don't care. But there is no direct connection, because one is in time and one is outside time. And you have to have something to bridge that gap. Who bridged the gap with the angels sent down? Some of them went back to the source and reported. Some of them stayed in the creation. And those were the Anunnaki. We call them Anunnaki, and it means those who from heaven came to earth, ki being earth, right? The Anunnaki word for earth is ki. And so they came down, and they moved down those 22 levels over eons and eons of time. From the beginning of the creation, they stepped down and down and down. And eventually, in many ways, they were worse than we are, scrapping and fighting and fornicating and generally bad behavior. In other words, the more dense they became, the more unhealthy they became, the more wrong paths they took, till eventually they were completely locked in to the creation, the same as all the other creatures here, the same as you and I came locked in.
Uh-huh. So how many different species that, I mean, you may not know, because this is a vast universe with how many billions, trillions of planets, universes, right out there? Yes?
Well, let's put it this way. Yes. And for every planet that has, remember how many planets have evolved, their sun has gone red dwarf and has died, and the civilization has died. Civilizations have risen and fallen for hundreds and thousands, millions of years. You know, I would say that for every planet that has produced life, there has been one species which has moved further forward than others. And when the planet itself was in a healthy state, meaning it had plenty of nutrients, plenty of capability of providing for its animals, and a good sun to heat it, in that scenario where you have a planet and a sun and the nutrients on the planet necessary, life evolves. Life develops and life evolves. And out of that evolution, you've had many, many intelligent species that have risen, and some of them have developed great, great civilizations. And then the sun has died, their sun has died, and the whole planet is frozen, and there's nothing left of it. it disappeared into stardust again, and it's maybe been remade into something else. In other words, there has never been a time since day one of this universe that it hasn't been changing. It is constantly changing. And although it may be true that, as science says, we have maybe another 9 billion years to live on this universe, right, as we know it, or our sun has so many million years left before it goes red dwarf. I mean, scientists get busy calculating these things all the time. What they're not taking into account is, first, they're only calculating from Earth, not from anywhere else in the universe, generally speaking. And secondly, they're not accounting for the fact that these rising up of life and dying down of life, the whole cycle of the cells in your body, of the individual person, of the planet, of the sun that you're in, these are constantly going on throughout the universe all the time. And so when we talk about the ETs, we are talking about really a very small number in a very small location. You know, I think I read it in a book somewhere, Earth is like the back end of the universe. It's the rear of the universe, because we're right down at the lowest end practically of the Milky Way. Even in our own neck of the woods, which is the Milky Way, there must be millions of planets capable of supporting life, and tens of thousands of them that I'm sure do. And some of those civilizations may be very advanced, just not interested in going to other places. The ones that we hear about are the ones that are very near to us, you know, just a few light years away, maybe 50 light years or 1,000 light years. They're close in. Tau Ceti and these places, Mars, our own planets in the whole solar system, and the systems around us, like the Pleiades, Orion, Orion, Sirius, Tau Ceti, these places, they are our near neighbors. And these are the ones that we are familiar with as extraterrestrials, the ones that we know about. And, like everybody else, some are good and some are bad.
Yeah.
They're quite separate, though, from the reptilians.
Well, this is it's a big picture, Alexander. As a matter of fact, there's a report. Oh, it's huge. The other day, there was a launch, well, some months ago, many months ago, there was a launch of the Webel telescope. Here's a report on that.
Webb's first official deep field. A patch of sky absolutely packed with galaxies. Some whose light is stretched and magnified by gravity.
There's actually a galaxy that's sort of twisted and bent, and it looks a lot like a Dali painting. There's this clock that's like melting. And, you know, in the case of the clock, it's time that's being warped. But here, it's actually space that's being warped. It's like life is imitating art. And, you know, just this feeling of surrealness that this is the actual universe that we're looking at.
It sounds like living in a science fiction movie, but we are not living in that anymore. This is science. This is real.
All of these galaxies, some about 13 billion years old, appear in a spot of the sky the size of a grain of sand held at arm's length.
It really makes you step back and think, oh my goodness, you know, that's just a speck of cosmic existence. And look at what we can see. We can see thousands of galaxies in a speck of sand. How infinite the universe must be.
These first images offer a tiny glimpse of what will come.
Think of it as like blowing open the door to a treasure chest. We're just looking in, peering from the door.
The great thing is that really, this is just the beginning. Today is just the beginning. We'll be able to go much, much deeper, and this telescope is going to do what we designed it to do.
The
So that's a big one. I mean, they got that telescope out there looking at a new...
It's fantastic that you can see things. Ever since the Hubble telescope went out there, it's brought a reality that people maybe didn't have before. But for me, as a personal thing, I do want to say this to anybody, though, who is interested, because when he talked about, you know, the warping of space, right, that it was a space that was warping, right? Well, time itself, when you go out of body into your spirit form and you step out there in infinite space, you can see the frequency that moves time, the movement of time. You can see it. And it's like a great river, just the most magnificent, glowing, silvery, shining river flowing through the universe. And as it flows around planets, it warps and bends. Time warps and bends according to the gravitational fields of the planets. That's why time is different in different locations and different in the interstellar space, because it changes. It gets slowed down, you might say, by the gravitational fields. But it's a magnificent thing to see. If ever you manage to get out of body and go out into space and take a look at it, it's magnificent. But you can, without even going out of body, you can get a sense of it because it makes a noise. There is a noise that, you know, like a river makes a noise when it's flowing, a background noise. Well, there is a background noise that flows through space with the river of time, and it sounds exactly like whale song. When I was over in Southeast Asia, I was in Singapore one day, and I was walking past this little shop, a little electronics shop, and I'd never even heard of whale sound at the time. This is many, many years ago. And I hear this noise coming out of this shop. And I was with my father, actually. He'd been visiting me, and we were in Singapore. And I heard this noise, and I stopped, and I said, Daddy, go back. Go back. Where is that sound coming from? He said, well, it's out of that shop. I said, but that's the sound of time. I have to go and find it. And I went into the shop and asked the man, and it was a little tape recording he had, one of those old-fashioned little tape things. And it was a whale sound. It was the first time I'd ever heard it. But that is exactly like it sounds when you get out into space, in spirit, when you're out there. So the reason I'm telling this little story is because I would love it if we have all kinds of problems on this planet. We talk about them all the time, the politics, the abortion laws, you know, the food supply, the wars, the problems. Earth has never come to the end of its problems. And I dare say it's never will, because it's a school. It's where we learn. But just take a moment and imagine yourself stepping out of all the troubles and difficulties and responsibilities that this life offers, and all the responsibilities that you have as an individual for which you are directly responsible. Give yourself a moment of freedom from that and say to yourself, yes, but one day I'm going to step out into this universe, and I'm going to experience, I'm going to hear the music of the stars, I'm going to see the supernovas, I'm going to have the opportunity to visit and participate in the magnificence and the wonder of this life, because that's what it is. The entire universe is a changing, magnificent, living organism. Everything that is, has a life. It is created, it grows into the maximum of itself, and then at some point it changes into something else. but it is all part of life, and it's all belongs to every individual to experience, to all of us, and we will have the opportunity to experience that. At some point, all of us will die from this physical experience, and maybe all we want to hope for is reincarnation into another life, and that's fine. That's what will be offered to all of us if we want it, and we can certainly take it. But once we have perfected the life on this planet, we will also be able to take life in physical form, not just as an airy piece of floating gossamer, you know, just floating around the universe, which is great too, I can tell you. But we will also have opportunities for other bodies that we can take to other places. So there is never any limit. But the first step, and the step we all need to be working on right now, is bringing back into our lives the fundamental teachings of Christ, who is one of these great beings of the universe, who is one of the very few beings capable of entering the center of the cosmos and visit other universes and return. And there are very, very few of those beings. I am told that there are known to be less than 2,000 in the entire universe that have that capability. So just because Christ came down and was a baby and a man, that he was also one of the most magnificent time lords of this universe, with the ability to move in and out of time at will. So when he said to us, everything I can do, you can do and more, what he was telling us we could do was enter and participate in the magnificence of this universe totally. It's the gift he gave us by telling us that, by setting that goal for us, and he told us how to do it. You have to live the golden rule. You have to be perfect like your Father in heaven is perfect. And that Mr. Ledwith even spelled out the steps taken so that you can complete it in this lifetime, not in some future lifetime, but right here and right now on planet Earth, there is the opportunity to complete the cycles of earthly reincarnation for each and every one of us. I don't care what level you think you're at now. I don't care what you know. I don't care how good or bad you've been up till this point. You know that. Nobody else needs to know it, right? You are still able at this point in your life, regardless of your circumstances, with date of your soul, you are able to correct it, to fix it, to perfect it, and to have the entire cosmos available to you. And you're able to do that in this lifetime. And if you really want to do it, read Mr. Ledwith's book. If you want to do it and you are a serious person, you will take the time to read and understand that book. But I also understand the pressures of life and that some of you just don't have that time. And so one of these days when Russell and I are talking back and forth, we will discuss that book in some detail, and I will make a précis of it for you to tell you how to do it, how to perfect yourself so that you can reach Christ consciousness, which means perfect balance in this lifetime. And that means that when you leave this lifetime that you're experiencing now, you will have the whole universe open to you. And if you want to get a sense of the wonder of it, then just start listening to some whale sound. The beauty of that sound brings the magic of the universe to you.
Okay. You were saying that people can reach nirvana, but yet, just getting back for a moment or two to the problems that we're facing, look at the people who are demonstrating in the streets about the Roe versus Wade deal, that women are upset that they are losing.
Quite rightly.
Okay, you say rightly. So what do we do about that then? How do we resolve that in this time before we get to Nevada, where, you know, cum laude,
well,
where everybody...
First I want to say Nirvana is the goal of Buddhism, and the principles of Buddhism are what was taught by Jesus Christ. However, as a follower of Christ, you are not headed for Nirvana. Nirvana is a state of being where you are simply absorbed into the totality of all that is, right? In other words, you just become part of the whole. Now, that is the ultimate goal of every soul, whatever the soul experiences. The ultimate aim of every soul is to be returned to the source. However, what I'm talking about and what Christ was talking about was continuing to live immortally, eternally, as a sentient being, knowing yourself and choosing the experiences you would have, as opposed to disappearing into the wellspring of the all. And they are two quite different experiences, quite different ideas. In fact, I discussed this one time briefly in emails with a professor of Buddhism who had done one of those great courses things, and it was a wonderful course on Buddhism, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. But when I wrote to him and discussed this point, he actually wrote back to me and said it was interesting that that's what I understood from it, and he'd never thought of that, and he would give it some thought, right? So there really is a difference between heading for Nirvana and heading for what we might call a Christian heaven as a follower of Christ, or a follower of the great beings, because Christ didn't set out to be a Christian. Christ was a Jew who taught an ethic, and the word Christ actually means light. It's all a word, it's I believe, the Greek word. So having said that, back to the issue of what should we do about...
Because we do have a problem here. We have a problem.
Well, we do. But as the court has turned it back to the states, we all have state government, right? And so it behoves us all to contact our state representatives, and come November, make sure that we elect representatives who will take into account women's issues, and particularly the issue of abortion, and make sure that they are going to vote in favor of what the majority of women in your state may want. You know, it's perfectly possible that because we behave, America is a republic, and as you know, a republic means a small group of people ruling the masses, right? America was never a democracy, but we behave as if we are a democracy in that we tend to at least pay tribute to the idea of one man, one vote, a majority rule. Now, we all know by the illegal voting machines and the manipulations of elections, et cetera, that that really is not working for us. However, we still pay lip service to that principle. And on that principle, if you believe in abortion as part of the medical care that should be available to women, then you need to make sure that the state that you choose to live in has a government which supports that. If you are in favor, in other words, a pro-choice state, if, however, you are in favor of no abortion under any circumstances, then go live somewhere like Texas, where they're not going to allow it. In other words, you have choice. Always you have choice. There is always some means to deal with this. And when it comes to, quite frankly, to the poor people who are the worst affected by these terrible choices, I hate to think how many backstreet abortionists are going to start turning up and damaging these women forever. But generally speaking, if you are a poor person meaning you know your job is a low paid job, and you live in low circumstances because of the inability to get a high paying job, then it's generally easier for you to get on a Greyhound bus and go live somewhere else. And that's what I would suggest people do. It's certainly what I would do. I would not want an abortion myself, but if I were in a situation where I did want that service available to me, or as a matter of principle, I would go and live in a state which allowed it. So it's no use fighting wars and throwing bombs and bricks through clinic windows, and that doesn't help anybody. That just creates more chaos. And I think those activists who are against abortion, who shoot at doctors and nurses in abortion clinics and barricade them to stop poor women who need an abortion from going in there, or, you know, really abusing them, as that, I think those people, quite frankly, should be locked up. To me, that is criminal what they're doing. They are abusing their fellow humans who have just as much right to their point of view. So we have to accept that people have different points of view. Some people agree to something and some people don't. Now, this, for instance, some people like to smoke cigarettes or tobacco, cigars, pipe, and some people don't. Now, I do think that banning smoking in public places is totally right, because why should people who don't like smoke be invaded with it? But at the same time, I don't think that when it comes to using tobacco in private homes, there should be any rules, as indeed there aren't. In other words, if it's in your own space and you're not polluting anybody else's space, then it should be allowed. And I think this is the same simple rule applies to abortion. It's a uh-huh. woman's body. It should be her choice.
Well, it's a big fight coming up, because the Supreme Court, in its wisdom, so to speak, and I've used that.
well, I don't think there is any wisdom coming out. I think what there is coming out of the Supreme Court in the last 20 years is party politics.
They're well, of course it is. We know that.
Politics.
Because even if we were to go back to the laws of the Supreme Court, back to 1896, 1857, the Percy versus Ferguson rule of 1896, where they said it should be official and it's okay to have separate but equal facilities. And as a result of that, the KKK, the Ku Klux White Citizens Council, the people who hate people who are people of color, decided to dump down on them and hang them and commit all kinds of unspeakable crimes against people of color, whether it be Native Americans who now reside on reservations, and still the poverty rate, the unemployment, the alcoholism, whatever it is, above any other ethnic group of this country is the highest. But anyway, Martin Luther King said it this way in his fight when he was here about the Supreme Court and rules and unjust rules.
The fact is that the Negro was a slave in this country for 244 years. That act, that was a willful thing that was done. The Negro was brought here in chains, treated in very inhuman fashion. And this led to the thingification of the Negro. So he was not looked upon as a person. He was not looked upon as a human being with the same status and worth as other human beings. And the other thing is that human beings cannot continue to do wrong without eventually rationalizing that wrong. So slavery was justified morally, biologically, theoretically, scientifically, everything else. And it seems to me that white America must see that no other ethnic group has been a slave on American soil. That is one thing that other immigrant groups haven't had to face. The other thing is that the color became a stigma. American society made the Negro's color a stigma. And that can never be overlooked. So I think these things are absolutely necessary. The other thing is that America freed the slaves in 1863 through the Emancipation Proclamation of Abraham Lincoln, but gave the slaves no land or nothing in reality, and as a matter of fact, to get started on. At the same time, America was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that there was a willingness to give the white peasants from Europe an economic base. And yet it refused to give its black peasants from Africa, who came here involuntarily in chains and had worked free for 244 years, any kind of economic base. And so emancipation for the Negro was really freedom to hunger. It was freedom to the winds and rains of heaven. It was freedom without food to eat or land to cultivate, and therefore it was freedom and famine at the same time. And when white Americans tell the Negro to lift himself by his own bootstraps, they don't look over the legacy of slavery and segregation. I believe we ought to do all we can and seek to lift ourselves by our own bootstraps, but it's a cruel jest to say to a bootless man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. And many Negroes, by the thousands and millions, have been left bootless as a result of all of these years of oppression and as a result of a society that deliberately made his color a stigma and something worthless and degrading.
Now, that's a big issue today in today's society, that no one is really addressing the NAACP, the Urban League, or whatever organizations out there, OIC, Opportunities, Industrialization Centers, whatever. We haven't resolved that issue, and people would like to keep it quiet and not address that issue in the society, in spite of the fact that people are now integrating, so to speak, like Malcolm says, though, in a burning house. Now, how do we look at that? How do people from other parts of the universe, the Palladians, the Reptilians, the Greys, the Nordics, the whatever, the tall whites, how do they view that activity that has occurred that nobody else really wants to talk about?
Well, first of all, most of the extraterrestrials that interact with this planet think we're a pretty crazy lot and that we are stupid and that that's why they can steal us and use us as slave labor in Antarctica and all these other places, the mining camps in Mars and the asteroid belt, and let the reptilians snatch our scientists and take them and sell them to other parts of the universe, which I understand is what goes on these days. And it's partly because we don't learn, which is where we started today. We don't learn the lessons. We keep repeating them, right? And at the same time, we dwell in the past in unhealthy ways. So how do we deal with this issue? Well, I think one of the issues is I have to ask you this question. If most people have not taken advantage of the opportunities that the United States of America offers all its citizens at this point in time, if they haven't already taken that opportunity, what is it that's going to make them take those opportunities? You can't, it's kind of like, you know, when you have a bad parent who abuses you and beats you and ill-treats you as a child, right? When you grow up, you have to recognize the truth of what happened to you. You have to make darn sure that you don't want to behave in the same way. And then you have to say, okay, now I have to get on with my life. I cannot spend all my life allowing what my parents did to me to drag me down and influence me. I have to make something better with my life. So if we have to do that with bad and abusive parents from this lifetime, how much do we have to do it from events in history 200 years ago? We have to learn from those events. We have to make sure they never happen again. And then we have to get on with our opportunities that are available today. I mean, I don't know what good it does anybody. I don't find it helpful constantly living in the past. Learn the lessons from it and move on.
Well, people would like to say that, but if you look at the prison systems of the United States, that's that same kind of racism and exclusionary process continues. There's a book called, I can't think of that girl, she's written about the prison system. She did a magnificent job.
Go ahead. Excuse me interrupting you, Russell, but what I think you're talking about two different things. You're talking about the racial injustice that exists in the United States today.
That still exists.
That's what I'm saying. Hear me. The racial injustice that exists in the United States today, which has been exacerbated, in my opinion, even since World War II. And I don't believe, and I think the reason why we don't solve it is because we are not addressing it for what it is, an issue related to greed, power, and avarice in today's society, and really has nothing much to do with the history of slavery 200 years ago. Now, if you want to equate the history of slavery with 200 years ago, I think you have to equate it with in the present. I think you have to equate it with the life in today's factories in America, where the least amount of money is paid that the unions will let them get away with terrible jobs where they literally, as they say, sell their soul to the company overseers, right? The company, you know, they go into somewhere like a Ford factory and they spend the next 30 or 40 years slaving away. And they still can not have a great life out of it, right? That's today's slavery. And it goes on all the time. And that is, I think that kind of slavery today is equal between people of color and white people, that you have equal numbers of those represented in those kind of factories. And America's companies have taken that kind of ongoing slavery to other countries, third world countries around the world, like Costa Rica, Nicaragua, Thailand, Vietnam, all over the world, American companies, white American companies predominantly, have taken that old form of slavery out of using people for a pittance and essentially owning their lives because they have no other choices. So I think when you talk about that, those are the things that equate one to the other that have to be changed and stamped out all around the world. And I can think of lots of things we need to do to take care of that. But the issue that we have with actual racial problems in this country that have exacerbated since World War II, those are a completely different and more terrible issue because the people caught up in it have almost no choice. You know, when I think of that young man who was jogging through that white neighborhood, the young boy of color, I've terribly forgotten his name, Trey, I think it was. He was just a young kid, 17-year-old, out jogging with his earpieces in, and he happened to jog through a predominantly white neighborhood, and the neighborhood watch came out and shot him. And thank goodness they've charged both those two men involved and thrown them to jail for a life. They're locked up as they should be, right? But this is the kind of issue that is our real racial issue today. Nothing to do with slavery, to do with actual difference in races that for whatever reason have not learned to get along with each other and respect each other as equal citizens of this country, this planet. And I will say it again, and I've said this before, everybody needs to remember that if they're on this planet as human beings at this time, they have certainly had multiple reincarnations in the past. And during those reincarnations, they themselves have been every color and race that you can think of. Every soul experiences all the varieties, right? And the other thing that they should remember is that the foundation of Homo sapiens is out of the colored people of Africa, and that they are the original Homo sapiens, and fundamentally, they are the ones who were given rulership of this planet by the Anunnaki, the okay. people that used to be called Sheba. So we need proper respect for people. And I don't think continually going back to what happened 200 years ago is very helpful.
But listen, for the last several weeks, we have always talked about what happened 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years, 100,000 years
right.
ago, or 20,000. Wait. We talk about the Anunnaki, that they've been here on the planet, and they created the human being. We're back in history, but nobody wants to really get down to the nitty-gritty and talk about black Americans and the suffrage of black Americans or the Jewish people and the concentration camps that Hitler provided for them.
I wanted to address
that because it seems to be ignored. And even if we go back just 100 years ago, when we talk about Frederick Douglass, when he says the limits of tyrants are prescribed by the endurance of those whom they oppress, and he says this about the 4th of July.
What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days of the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is a constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham. Your boasted liberty, an unholy license. Your national greatness, swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your denunciation of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence. Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy. A thin veil to cover up crimes that would disgrace a nation of savages. There's not a nation of the earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of these United States at this very hour. At a time like this, scorching irony, not convincing argument, is needed. Oh, had I the ability and could reach the nation's ear, I would today pour forth a stream, a fiery stream of biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm, and stern rebuke. For it is not light that is needed, but fire. It is not the gentle shower, but thunder. We need the storm, the whirlwind, the earthquake. The feeling of the nation must be quickened. The conscience of the nation must be roused.
So, everyone wants to keep quiet. The book I was referring to about the injustices that happen to be covertly and overtly participated in, even today, 2022, in the penal systems of America, is that Michelle Alexander has written a book, The New Jim Crow. And we need to read that book because it talks about the same irony, the same devastating policies that have been implemented against people of color in the prison systems and other systems, overtly and covertly, are still existing today. So at some point, the nation has to address those issues as the Jewish people had to, as the Nazis had to address the fact that Hitler slaughtered, maimed, and destroyed the Jewish community and to the millions and millions and millions of people. So that has to be addressed at some point. So it's nice to talk about people being abducted, taken to the moon, people putting underground bases, not only over the United States, but in Antarctica. But that same system that still exists. Here's a lady who trying to address the issues, and I don't want to get into it except to probably close it out in a few minutes by having you to say what she is to answer or see what she's saying.
Charges have been dropped against the white woman who called police on a black man birdwatching in Central Park last year. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office dropped the misdemeanor charges against Amy Cooper earlier today. Cooper had been charged with falsely reporting an incident after a viral video surfaced of an altercation with an African-American man. Prosecutors say Cooper completed appropriate education and therapy classes on racial equity up to their satisfaction.
So anyway, we are still dealing with those issues, and I'm just saying, as the Anunnaki,
yes,
the Dracos, the Cabal, the Illuminati, whomever, how are we going to address that issue? Because that's still smoldering in the souls of many Americans today.
Well, you know, that the speaker that you had on before, that gentleman, and I presume he's a preacher from the way he was delivering his address, I totally agree with everything he was saying. But then I'm a thunderclap type of person who, you know, go out and yell about it. But it is certainly not what Christ, you know, if you remember during the life of Christ, then the movement against the evil Romans, the government that were the evil Romans at the time, there was that huge movement with the zealots, and the zealots were all for terrorist acts. They were the activists of the day at the time of Christ, were the zealots. And the disciples wanted Jesus to be a zealot. And he said, no, in the long run, that doesn't help anything. And I have to agree with that the hardest thing to do very often in life, in fact, certainly for most people, including myself, the hardest thing to do is nothing. And this is where faith comes in. You have to have faith. You have to know what's right. Because think of it this way. If every single one of us, all of us, no matter what color, what creed, all of us, was actually trying to do what was right and live the golden rule, there would not be any of these problems. They would not exist because we would be treating each other with care, with love, with respect, as we should be, right? And I recognize the terrible situation of race relations in America, and I have to say I have never seen it anywhere else. But I also have seen how it springs up with other groups of people. When I've worked overseas and I've seen other white foreigners come into the local community and how badly they've behaved towards the local people. So I see how this springs forth. And you're right, it has to be changed. And that's the thing about America, that America has a constitution which laid down the principles as the foundation for the possibility of that change. And really, I think that's why everybody is in America. We're all here. It's this huge melting pot. And if we can't get it right in America, there's not much hope for the rest of the world, because we have all the possibilities and all the problems. We just have to get our heads together to solve them. And shooting and killing one another and causing mayhem is not going to solve the problem. It's just going to throw you know, oil on the fire and make it burn harder. So where in principle I agree with what that preacher was saying about, you know, we need thunder and lightning and fire and not gentle rain. That would be my personal general take on it. Underneath that, I know, yeah, that would be satisfying, but it would not in the long run solve the problem.
But then Jesus said, when I return, wait a minute, when Jesus said, I return, what did he say?
He said he was bringing the sword. Play nice was over and he was bringing the sword.
Oh,
and
thank you.
That's what I talk about all the time, is that this is our last chance. We have to get it right. We have to. And the only way that I know that we can get it right is if we really make an effort to love one another. Whether somebody agrees with us or disagrees with us is irrelevant. We really have to like, to respect, and to love one another. And even when we can't respect and like one another, we do have to learn to love one another, because we have to learn to love the soul of the person, even if we don't like their actions. And I guess that's a good starting point for people who have a problem. I'm addressing now the idea of white people who have a problem with people of color, or people of color who have a problem with white people, because it's a two-way street. There are plenty of people of color who can't stand white people.
Why?
I don't know why. I've never had a problem with anybody.
Let me educate you a little bit. This lady is a psychiatrist. Her name is Dr. Frances Wells.
I think, again, the implications, first of all, we need to understand that this discussion doesn't occur in the vacuum. It occurs within what I call a global, national, local system of white supremacy. Now, what do I mean by that? I maintained, and have for the past quarter century, that the behavior that we see, including this focusing, comes about because the white population on the planet is a tiny minority population. It's not people of color who are the minorities. Whites are fewer than one-tenth of the population on the planet. Number two, and perhaps most importantly, white. You see, when white people say, I am white, they are talking genetically about a genetic recessive characteristic that is a variant of albinism, not defined by Frances Welsing. Now, that genetic recessive characteristic plus the minority status means that the white population can conceivably be genetically annihilated by genetically dominant black, brown, red, and yellow people in terms of skin coloration. So my thesis in the Crest Theory was that all of the behavior, you see, the repression of blacks, the attack on black males in particular, the lynching, the castration, the obsession with saying something is wrong with your genetics, because at a subconscious level, whites are aware we are the population on the planet that is genetically vulnerable.
Okay. So, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. I just wanted to address that issue because in many discussions, it has been ignored. And I think at some point as we close today, that has to be addressed. There's one book out there, B as in boy, H as in history, 365.org, that talks about the rightful place of blacks in America and throughout the world, economically, politically, socially, psychologically, philosophically, and in terms of all the inventions. So if you just punch up B as in boy, H365.org, you'll see a very comprehensive scholarly book that has been just completed on the history of blacks in America and what we should be doing with ourselves and helping other people to resolve this issue, if there's any hate, animosity.
I agree with you. I'm not disagreeing with any of the things that you say on this issue, Russell. I'm sure you know a great deal more about it than I do or ever will. And I'm not disagreeing with you at all. What I think is sad is that when I first came to America, almost everybody would say to me, are you Australian? Are you New Zealand? I said, no, I'm changed my citizenship. I'm an American. Americans don't say they're American. They say they are whatever, right? But they rarely say, I'm an American. They say, oh, I'm a German. Or they'll even say, oh, I'm a Jew. Or I'm a born-again Christian, right? They'll let you know what their beliefs are. They'll let you know what their ethnic history is. But you almost never hear them saying, I am an American. Now, this is radio. Nobody can see me. Nobody out there who is listening can possibly know 100% what color I am. What meaning the color of my skin? What difference does it make? If they are out there, supposing, for example, five people are listening today, and there's a black person listening, a Vietnamese, a Chinese, a Russian, and a Polish person. Half of them colored, half of them white, right? And those five people happening to be listening to me today, on some things they will agree with me, on some things they may take issue with me, right? But we are all six of us human beings interacting together. And that's what we need to do. So when people write these, I'm sure this book you're talking about is good information, very learned, very accurate, very true. But what difference does it make if it still separates point I'm forever trying to make?
Okay, well, here's the point.
It doesn't matter what color we are.
Well, here's the
now,
point.
I know
but you make it an issue. You despise, resent, have some animosity against the reptilian, right? For whatever reason. Or the Palladians,
no,
right?
No.
You have
never heard me say I despised anybody. I have said that they are very different and that they have a very different perspective and that they have a very different perspective to me or, in the case of reptilians, the human species. I have tried to explain them. But I have never said who am I to despise anything that the Creator created?
Okay.
What right do I have? And that's what everybody should understand. No single person has the right to despise anything that the Creator created. And if the Creator decided some people should be blue, some people should be green, some people should be yellow, some should be white, and some should be black, all the colors of the rainbow, then who are we? As individuals, any of us, where do we get off despising or denigrating anybody at all who is different to us? We don't. We don't have the right to do it.
But if I go back and listen to what you have said for the past 4 or 5 weeks about even the Palladians now, you have some questions about their goals, their intentions. And you say the same thing about the reptilians. So there's a division here that people, if they listen, they hear the division here, that the Anunnakis are the greatest, wonderful people in the vastness of the universe.
The only time I ever said anything about what the Anunnaki were like, I said, and then they degenerated to a fighting, fornicating bunch of wrecks. That's what I said about us. Something like that. That's what I said about the Anunnaki, because I'm telling the truth, right? I'm not making a judgment of that. I'm just saying the way it is. Now, what I said about the Pleiadians was that they use the ability to, in some way, keep staying young and lengthening their lives so that I understand they live on average for 1,000 years. And that they put out a very nice message to the people who channel them. And it really, the message they put out is a message of sweetness and light, which it is. However, what I said was that I would question any extraterrestrial group, including the Pleiadians, that wanted to make inroads on our planet. I would want to know what their agenda was. And I would say exactly the same thing in this issue that we're talking about people of a different race. Ask the questions. Don't either denigrate or praise, but ask the questions. Ask the question, why do these particular group of people seem to behave in this particular way towards me or towards the different people that we interact with? And so certainly ask the questions, look for the answers, read the material, right? But boil it down to the fact that we are all creations of the created, of the Creator, and that has to be respected, even when we are not in agreement with what is going on. We don't know why the greys are bad news for humans. That I know. They abduct, they manipulate, they do surgeries on, they've done a lot of bad things. But we don't know why they're doing that. And we have to ask those questions. We can't just write them off as a species. And we can't just write off the reptilians. The reptilians are very bad for the human species. And very many bad-intentioned humans work with the reptilians. And it's never to the benefit of the rest of us. It's to the benefit of granting power and wealth to a very few. And that cannot be right by any measure. Nobody can think it's right. So it's not about condemning people, any people. And when it comes to humanity and all the varieties of humanity, we see several of them on this planet, different variations. And we see that by the form of their bodies and the color of their skin. And if we want to interact with the rest of the universe, where there are many forms of bodies that are a lot different to ours, not just the different shape of the eyes or the color of the skin, but differences in a major way, like four arms instead of two, right? We have to resolve our issues here. We have to respect one another as humans. Be always fighting. And like the little example I gave, nobody knows what color I am. I could be any color because they don't see me. They just hear what I'm saying. But they're not seeing me.
All right.
And you could be any color to me.
How do we begin to bridge the gap between all the people that we have questions about? How do we bridge the gap on this planet? How do we do that? I mean, it's a difficult question, I know. Almost
it's
impossible.
It's a very difficult question, and it is. But the first thing we have to do is love ourselves. Most people you will find who, whether it's a group or an individual, most people who have a hatred of somebody else have something that they dislike intensely about themselves, maybe even a hatred of themselves. Right, they don't. This thing, and they join groups of other people who have the same hatred, because they have this. I would venture to say that in this day and age, apart from a few exceptions, anybody who actively, and I say actively, the word advisedly means active in their thinking, anybody who actively goes about saying they hate, for example, they hate black people, they hate the Chinese, they hate the Koreans, whatever. They hate themselves. They feel bad about themselves. They have no sense of self-worth. They might have a massive ego, but a massive ego is not the same as a sense of self-worth. And if you have no love and value of yourself, you are incapable of having love and value for other people. If you don't respect yourself, you're incapable of respecting other people.
Right.
So this bridging of the gap has to begin with people examining themselves and loving themselves. And then they can gradually expand that love genuine love to their friends, their families, and then to the broader scope of humanity. And okay. Once they do it, then it's easy.
Right. I'm just saying, as I look at this big picture that we have painted in the past three or four broadcasts, that there's a serious problem here. Now we're creating another problem, as David Wilcox and Corey Good and Dr. Greer and others have, with this disclosure stuff coming up, and that's going to create more division. How do we bring it all together without some kind of big fight of 1860, if you will? And I'm talking about,
well, you know,
the war between the states. How do we resolve this?
I hate to say this, but I have been waiting and anticipating the high possibility of a third world war, where all nations are engulfed in their own borders, dealing with these kinds of issues of the inequality and unfairness that exists as a general rule across this planet today. And America is the big showcase of that, with the inequality and injustice with regard to people of color in this country. It is huge. So what we manifest as, you know, a volcano, the rest of the world manifests in the same way, but to a lesser degree or a less obvious degree, because what it really is, and it's across the face of this planet, is the unfairness of distribution of the things available for life between those who have and those who have not. And that's really the division. And here in America, because it's mostly in this country, the people of color who have not, right? And the people of no color, the white people, who have, right? And that's just the way it is, and it's true. It's mostly the white people who have everything, and the people of color don't have anything. So it's this unfairness of those who have and those who have not. And I think that it may, I've been afraid for years that it may come to civil war, but war all across the world, not just here, but all over. Because there is, I don't know any countries today that have true fairness and distribution, even equality before the law, you know, that it just isn't there. Everything is so unfair on this planet. And it's just saying, well, who expects, you know, life to be fair? Well, I do. I expect life to be fair. So...
So do you think David is going to say, let's just get rid of it like they did with Lemuria, if you will, Antarctica? I mean, just get rid of all of it and start all over again? You think that's a good point?
I think we have to. I don't know how we are going to resolve this without, I hate to say it, but I still see some kind of civil war in this country.
Well, we had one.
I don't want it to happen.
600.
It's so terrible. You know.
Yeah, 600,000 men, women, and children were killed during that.
I know. It's unimaginable, and one never wants to think of it. But unless we get our heads out of the sand and start doing what is right to ourselves and our neighbors, I don't know what other resolution there can be.
You think
because
Jesus coming back will help? You think Jesus coming back
will
help?
He said he's going to bring a sword and whip everybody into shape with it. So, you know, we have to remember that when he went into the temple and saw the money changers in the temple, he took a big stick to them, a big whip, and whipped them out of the place. So Christ is no pacifist. He never was. I think that he will tolerate when he comes back to, as it were, take charge of the management on this planet, I don't think that he will tolerate this inhumanity of man to man, because that's what it is. It really is. It's unforgivable. And I have never been able to understand it. My whole life, I have, and especially this white supremacy thing, where, you know, the whites think for some reason that they are superior and they own this planet. I think it was true to say up till maybe even 100 or 150 years ago that at that time in history, the white people were the most inventive, the most technologically advanced, and the most highly educated, because those things had not been a requirement in the nations of Africa. And so the colored people came out of Africa with less education in the way that we considered education, in the way that one is educated intellectually to manage businesses and be inventive and make money. So we always, the white people always have the lead in making money. But we tend to forget when we talk about these things that the Chinese as a nation had written language over 4,000 years ago and a great civilization from 5,000 years ago. And so the white people should really remember that and walk very carefully, because the Chinese as a race are light years ahead of the white people in knowledge
an assignment
and wisdom
I want to give
and experience.
I have an assignment. I want people to Google the inventions of black people in America in the last 400 or 500 years.
I know, since they came to America, they've been massive. I'm not saying that. But try and think of it in this way, that I think that the antagonism of whites towards black stems out of one root, not just the genetics, as that lady was saying, but I think it stems out of fear. They are afraid of the black people. Now, think of it in this way. I told you a little story a long time ago about how our planet is crowded with extraterrestrials wanting to live as humans on this planet at this time, because this was the most astounding planet in the universe, and humans were something to be marveled at, because they'd only been Homo sapiens, in other words, self-aware, intelligent humans, self-acting humans, for 6,000 years. And yet in that time, a huge percentage of that population had advanced to the level where they could break out of the cycles of reincarnation already, and that speed of advancement had never been seen in history before, right? Now, think of that same pattern in relation to the people out of Africa, the people of color from Africa predominantly, and the white people from the northern climes. The white people from the beginning, from 6,000 years of being Homo sapiens, but before that, I want to go back before that to when they were Neanderthal, when they Cro-Magnon. They were already living in tribal groups, developing tools to work with, building homes, preserving food. Then they got turned into Homo sapiens as the genes spread, and then they really advanced in their ingenuity and development. And that went on for a very long time, for 2,000 or 3,000 years, when that kind of ingenuity and invention and development was not necessary if you lived in a country like Africa, because food was easily got, and there were all the benefits of having jungle territory around because it contains all the healing, everything else that you need. Trust me, life in that environment is a whole lot easier than life in a freezing northern environment. And you don't need the, I've lived in both climates. And believe me, living in a tropical climate is easier living than living in the north. Now, that's just a reality of time. And so the white people were used to being in charge and inventive long before it became necessary for the black people to do so. Now, I'm not saying Africa didn't have high development in some areas. The Dogon people, for example, who were visited by extraterrestrials and knew all the history of Sirius and everything else long before they put up the Hubble telescope, the people of the Dogons knew all about it. And the Zulu people, they were a highly advanced civilization, the Zulus, in Africa. So I am not saying they didn't have advanced civilization. They had. And in that context, I don't consider America a civilized country. I consider the Zulu nation of Africa 400 years ago a high civilization because they treated their people right. Here, we don't treat our people right, and therefore we are not civilized. So it's not about civilization. And it wasn't until the black people of Africa, those who were forcibly sold essentially by their own people into slavery and brought to America, that they, and then emancipation occurred, that they began to be ingenious. But when you think about it, all the times that black Africans enslaved, when they were slaves, that's when I think they were pushed to develop their ingenuity. Because when you are in a situation of slavery, when you are a slave and you own nothing and have nothing, you have to develop the brain's ability to be ingenious and inventive in order to have any life at all. Now, I'm saying this from a position of having had the experience in a previous life, and it no longer troubles me, but in two previous lives, I was sold into slavery and had that experience. Once it was in the Middle East, and another time it was down in South America. So I've had the experience of being enslaved to somebody else. And I know that if you don't develop your ingenuity and your brain, your life will not have any value to you at all. So I think it's since coming to America that the African people that came here have really, really come to the fore, caught up with, and in many cases surpassed the ingenuity of white people. So yes, I agree with you that there's nothing wrong with their inventive capabilities, but I think they developed them out of necessity.
Okay, let me ask you, I don't want to go back to 10,000 years ago or 20,000. Let somebody else who is really knowledgeable about the history of all of that come to the fore with Monday and talk about that. But you say that you were sold into slavery in South America. What was the situation around that, if I may?
Oh, well, I misspoke when I said South America because it wasn't. It was southern Mexico. I was an indigenous Indian in southern Mexico, and this is about maybe 250 years ago. And I was sold as a slave, and I was, funnily enough, I was bought and owned by the Jesuit priests at a mission. And the mission was on the border of what is now Arizona and Mexico. It was right in that border territory. And I had to work doing all the menial tasks and all the manual labor. You know, we lived in a compound and the well was in the middle, and 4 o'clock every morning I had to go and drag up buckets of water for the priest, and there were three or four nuns that had been sent to this little mission. It was like a tiny village thing. And I was bought by the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church is terrible for using slaves. Always has been.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then you mentioned you were in slavery in Africa or somewhere?
No, in the Middle East.
In the Middle East?
In the Middle East. That's a long time ago. That's about 2,000 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And on that occasion, I was a Persian. I was birthed by birth. I was a Persian. And my father was, I know this sounds a bit silly, but he was actually a dealer in Persian carpets and fabrics. And he used to go from what is Tehran along the Silk Route, the old Silk Route, into the Middle East and Egypt, take a lot of his stuff to Egypt. And he had only one child, me, and he didn't have a son. So he taught me to read and write. When I was grown up, about 18 or 20, he took me with him to act as his scribe and accountant. And I'd been on more than one, many trips with him. And on this particular trip, our caravan, there were a lot of different people in the caravan, was attacked by brigands that, funnily enough, came out of northern Turkey, I think. Maybe a bit further over, Turkestan maybe. But anyway, they came down from the north and we were attacked. And I was taken and I was sold in the slave market in Thebes, in the city of Thebes. And I was bought by a Roman soldier who was in charge of that area. He was like he had 100 soldiers, you know, a centurion. And he was in charge of that whole, the city of Thebes and the whole area. And he kept me there. That's where I was, as a slave to him. And because I could read and write, he eventually found that out and made me a scribe to him. And the interesting thing about that is that I have actually met him in this lifetime. And we met at a conference and we recognized each other and we just sat down and, you know, had a good laugh and a talk about the old times. But I was lucky because he was a good master. Everybody liked working for him. And that was a long, long piece of history for me because eventually one of his friends came from Rome to visit him and actually fell in love with me and married me. And I remember like yesterday, I had a slave bangle. It was like about an inch wide copper bangle tight around my upper arm. And on the day that I was to be married, my master took that off that arm and put it on the other arm to show that I was no longer a slave. And then my new husband and I, we lived in Thebes for a long time because he was wary about taking me back to Rome. You know, he was a freeman of Rome. And it was a long time before he took me back, many, like 20 years. And for a long time, we had a vineyard. We grew grapes up the slope of a volcano that eventually erupted. And we had a house in Thebes. It was a beautiful house, and the walls had lilies painted on them, beautiful big lilies all painted on the walls. I loved that mm-hmm. house.
Mm-hmm.
That was a long time ago.
Okay, so you decided...
I've met him as well.
Okay.
I've married him twice since then.
I see. So in Peru, you mentioned Peru.
Oh, in Peru, that was where I was the last time I was Anunnaki, where I got killed originally. And it's Peru today, but then it was just, you know, the coast of South America. And there's a great big plane up there. And when we came from... As Anunnaki, when we came from Egypt about 4,500 years ago from Egypt to that area, we landed on that big plain and made it base there. And interestingly enough, part of that area that we, you know, went up and down and lived in, is now in Ecuador. It's now called Peru and Ecuador, but it's this whole coastal area down there. And okay. A few years ago, when George and I went down to Ecuador, we made friends with a lady, Lucia, and she owns a family business. It's a water bottling plant, and it's on this huge estate, right? You know, she probably has 100 or 200 acres of property. So she has this bottling plant, and it's a family business, been with her family for years. And she spends her time wandering around, digging up these ancient rocks and stones that were from the time that I lived in that area. I mean, she and I made great friends because she had stuff that I could recognize that I knew was stuff from the days when the Anunnaki lived there. When I lived there with David and the rest of us, there were about 400 of us.
All right, we have about 2 minutes. In 2 minutes that we have left, David, with whom you are in constant contact with and have been for many eons, if you will, what is he saying about resolving the issues of aliens on planet Earth, the Earth people resolving their issues among each other? What does he see? What does he think will happen? Or do we just...
They have said that they learned the lesson of non-interference with a species, and they have no intention of interfering with us, but they are very concerned that we will destroy ourselves, that if we don't stop constantly on the micro level and the macro level of society, if we don't stop constantly tearing one another down and fighting, that we will destroy ourselves. And interestingly enough, about 50 years ago, soon after we developed the hydrogen bomb, you know, the soul energy is housed in your body as hydrogen molecules. And when we developed the hydrogen bomb, which disperses hydrogen molecules, not just the Anunnaki, but the Pleiadians and several species got very concerned that we would blow ourselves to bits and that we would use a hydrogen bomb, which would also have a ripple effect out into the universe and would affect all these other beings that are around us, especially those within the solar system. And so they actually put an electronic grid around this planet. This planet really is a prison planet now. It's very hard to get off it. And they have this huge electronic grid about maybe 200 miles out that encloses the astral belt and the planet itself. Absolutely out at the outer limits of our field, you know, our gravitational field. And they put that out so that if humans blew themselves to smithereens, they wouldn't be allowed to destroy the rest of the solar system or the other beings that are out there. They have not had a lot of hope for us for a long time because they thought we were totally true violent.
That happen in Atlantis? Was that totally destroyed?
Yes, it was a big problem in Atlantis, geological. That was geological. That was not bombs and splitting the earth. That was geological events that destroyed Atlantis, the earthquakes that destroyed Atlantis, right? But no, they were talking about us destroying ourselves and our planet using neutron bombs to do it. That's what they were worried about. However, in the last 20 years, 22 years, since after 2000, this something started on this planet. And before where it was, there were 40% of the population of this planet estimated to be capable of evolving to a higher level of life experience. That was reduced to 20% and is now considered to be maybe not more than 17% by 2000. However, since 2000. And I have to say it's due to the efforts of people like my dear George and David Icke and all the other, Jim Moore, all these other people who have been out there, all the whistleblowers coming out and telling the truth, and all the people trying to awaken the others, that there really has been and is currently a massive awakening going on this planet. So now it's like we're standing on the edge of a precipice. Will this massive awakening result in everybody turning to the truth and acknowledging it and moving forward? Or will it take us over the precipice of making them aware and making them so damn mad that they want nothing but revenge on everybody else and blow the whole thing up? So right now we're on that edge. We're standing on that precipice. And I'm just hoping and praying every day that we make the right choices, that we acknowledge all this truth, that we keep seeking the truth, but we don't turn to the dark side and demand revenge because of it, because that will just destroy us. We'll end up with civil war, global war, and it will be too horrible to think of.
Okay.
Too horrible.
Well, here we are. Thank you very much for your insight, your expressions, your hopes, your wishes, your willingness to come and share information with us and offer us some bits and pieces of how we can save ourselves, at least through maybe the book Saving Jesus by Ledwith. So that's one piece. But thank you. And we will close it for the day, but thank you very much. I appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Okay. Have a good
bye
one.
Bye now.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Yes, and you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye now.